these people are explaining what the answers have to dealt with the police, you know, after disaster, you know what I mean?
But police also, we're police, we don't want to.
Well, it's an active authority, but it's against the support, and like they were saying, you know what I mean, Liverpool at that time, you know what I mean, did have a bit of a name, but the thing is, we've always been a great follower of Liverpool anyway, it doesn't matter.
That's one side of the argument though, isn't it? They've amplified, they take the minimal, they take the minority view, and they make that say that the 2% disruption is something that becomes 90%.
Sure.
Well, trying to cloud the issue over about most people are actually peaceful.
Yeah.
And they're just trying to use politicisation of current affairs, basically.
Yeah.
They're using any event as a kind of a battering ram.
Yeah.
Basically to shout people down.
Really, basically. Right. Yeah. How about an interrupt?
No, thank you. Thanks.
I appreciate that. I'll give them a good kick in myself.
I just wanted to, I'm actually going to put my mate on the spot here in a minute and sit over there. But one of the things I'm involved in a radical history group, but when we were talking about this a few months ago about Hillsborough, and I've heard more things in the last week which have been very interesting things that have been said by people on phone-ins. But this thing that Dave's done about the policing, me and Dick were at a game, and we're West Ham United fans, we were at a game at Upton Park in 1981 against Chelsea, and we saw a fair bit of trouble at games over the years, but the most frightening experience I ever had, probably just about, I drowned once, that was pretty bad, but nearly died, but this is probably about the second worst thing that's happened to my life, and that was a West Ham United Chelsea game. And do you want to say what happened?
Queuing to get into the north bank of West Ham, I remember a lot of people trying to get in, and the police just set in a line of horses to clear the area, and I ended up probably three people under me with your feet off the ground in a position like that, and you're looking around and I was with him or with three other friends, and you're holding yourself up and you've got people under you and there's heads under them as well, and you're outside the ground and they're moving people on. I just kept coming forward, and it was just people who were putting.
You've got no control.
We were trapped against a load of turnstiles that had been shut. Right? So there was the West Upton Park was full, and there was thousands of us outside, and we were trapped, completely trapped. Very sort of similar situation. Luckily, outside the ground, not through some bloody tunnel or something. But we, by the walls up to, up to Park, we go around to the North Bank, you're trapped there, and they were sending horses in.
Yeah.
And I never understood to this day what, and we're all West Ham, there's no trouble.
Yeah.
I've never understood to this day why they are charging horses into the crowd who are trapped. Because all it did was, and that's the closest I've been to dying at a football.
Well, just in with what, when Dave was talking before about the police and of it, the next guy in charge, that has to be set in context to Merseyside police officers who had policed at Hillsborough, because they always send a local contingent anywhere, don't they, with visiting teams. And they referred to the previous year because it was a rerun of the previous year's game. And This guy was saying to me that what normally happened, because when you went down, as you got into that compound and you went down the pen, if you didn't know the ground, there was this central tunnel, and that was where you'd head for. You didn't know there was there and there, you see. And what happened was, in previous years, was they'd put a couple of police officers at the end of the tunnel to go that way or that way, because these central pens are full. And that normally happened, and it didn't happen that year. And what we found out was the guy who normally policed the Hillsborough ground was Superintendent Mole. And what had happened was, previously, a rookie cop was called out to an incident in a park, and when he got to the park, he had a gun put to his head and basically, really panicked. And it turned out it was two other cops kind of initiating him and just larking about. So the cop who had the gun put to his head, his father was a more senior officer who complained, and the guys who had done it, their commanding officer was Mole, and basically Superintendent Mole took the rap for his not having his officers under control and was taken off police in Hillsborough. And David Duckenfield was put in charge, and no one liked him. He was generally disliked amongst his peers, and he was also seen as inept. And basically there's an argument that the more experienced officers who were there, and there were experienced officers policing that day, basically it was just, he's in charge, leave him to it, that attitude. And again, just in line with what was being said previously and in the context, the officer that opened the gate, his name was Marshall. I remember him in court, and he summed it up for me, and it just really does reinforce the point made. He went, well, he opened the gate, and he said, well, I was used to dealing with crowds like this. I've policed the poll tax riots and the miners' strikes. So you see the context in which it's set.
The other thing was that at the inquest, Bands tried to give evidence that there had been police and stewards at the entrance to that tunnel the year before, and this was denied by the police barristers, and the coroner simply dismissed their evidence.
Even though I get that information from, I have got that information from a police inspector,
yeah,
a Merseyside police inspector. You see, so you know, did you want?
Yeah. A couple of questions, but also an observation as well. Is it true that the guy that was responsible for running the video in the surveillance box was not actually called to the inquest?
Yeah.
Secondly, I didn't know about the West Midlands Police and their role. I mean, I've had experience with the West Midlands Police 20 years ago at a football match at a place called Fellows Park in Walsall, actually starting a riot. And I can remember that there was actually a guy that was, I think, an off-duty police officer in the crowd that day that tried to complain against them, and then withdrew a complaint after 6 months because he was getting calls at home throughout the night and everything, quite hard-scale intimidation. But the other question really is there anything trade unions can do to help you with affiliations and all sorts of that? Because it strikes me that certainly in this city, there's a number of trade unions that would be more than happy to affiliate to your campaign and give you, any support you want, really.
Well, I think there is at the level of, and on Merseyside, it's been going to say the Fire Brigade Union in particular is one that stands out. Basically, the value of it is just that, aside from raising awareness, what it does is it just ups the ante as far as I'm concerned. It gives it such a high profile. It's not just, to paraphrase, whinging scousers, because let's face it, that's the reputation we have in some parts of the press. Oh, there they go again. There's some appalling coverage in the Irish press last week that I picked up on. And yet there was brilliant stuff in some of the papers over there as well. But this, and you saw it all after Hillsborough, self-pity city, that all of these terms come out. But what I feel is of value is that that general level of support from other people, because it is that class of thing of, it's us today, it could be you tomorrow. And, so I would always, and I know our group in particular, and we have spoken, over the years at a lot of trade union conferences, basically to highlight, and of course lots of our members, our active members, are members of, the main trade unions. So yeah, and as well, the thing is, we're always open to suggestions as well. I mean, we're a group, of like unpaid volunteers, and we're a mix, we are a diverse mixture, great mixture of people, and that we just kind of, we give of our skills, whatever we've got, when we can and where we can, and sort of just go along with the momentum. And the other thing is as well, is just how we at times shift away slightly from the campaign in terms of the main campaign for justice. We, sad to say, we've had to help a number of families over the years where they've died, and a lot of people have died, I would say, before the time, in the sense that the illnesses they've acquired, I think a lot of would be stress related. And the other sad thing is that we've had quite a number of survivors who've committed suicide. And that really, really is... I was with a woman on the day of the anniversary, she came in to see me with her daughter. And her husband was at Hillsborough. And I think it's about 2 years ago now, the daughter was 14, and she found her father hanging in the garage. And it was, she's got to live with that now, and it says something about the state of his mind that that he would inflict that on his daughter or his wife, you know. So, you know, a lot of the time we just help in practical ways. I mean, you know, we can have all the arguments around justice, whatever, but on a daily basis, sometimes someone, you know, needs a funeral to be paid for example, you know. And so we've been able to do those things. And there is a strength. And, you know, I often think about, you know, what will happen, you know, sort of, if the, as I said before, I think there'll be some kind of buy-off. And why it's important we make a noise at the moment is, I think that the authorities would just be quite happily dealing with the family support group, which is a group of people, well, basically two or three people, really, who don't put it out to the wider membership, can't be contacted in any way, don't rock too many boats, but are the acceptable face of it. So so basically our group would be seen, obviously, would be seen as more radical. But basically what I think is important is that the families in our group don't lose out in any discussions and debates around what is happening at the present time. And in a perverse way, I was quite pleased that the chief constable rang me. I can't believe I just said that. But I said to Daniel before, the funny thing was he said to me, oh, I know you're in Bristol, and because you're at the Cube tonight. And he went, now before you get paranoid, before you get paranoid, he said, I googled your name and you come up with that, came up top. So I said, I always work on the basis of at least two or three of you in the audience anyway, you know what I mean?
Can I just deal with the video question? Everyone knows that the police videos, the CCTV videos, went missing on the day. The guy in the CCTV room wasn't called to the inquest, but he was called to the Stuart Smith inquiry. And the transcript of his evidence to the Stuart Smith inquiry was that he could see the lapping of lane ends, he could see the crush, and he could see people in trouble. When Stuart Smith asked him what he thought when he saw people climbing over the crowd, he said, I thought it was a pitch invasion. There was then further video evidence. The BBC had six videos, which I was not involved. I said that, you know, I'm a lawyer. I was 19 at the time, so still a law student. My first involvement as a lawyer was 10 years down the line when I acted for one of the families. And I came into possession of the six BBC videos, which was the BBC footage of the events. And I was told that these had been lent to the Stuart Smith inquiry and then given back to the family. And the family never watched them. And I thought, oh God, am I really going to have to be able to watch through this? So I gave them to Nikki from the King's Cross Women's Centre and said, watch these videos. You got a picture of their son. Tell me what you can see. And she rang me up and she said, well, the first video is 20 minutes footage repeated all the time. So the highlight footage. And that's the footage currently on the Hillsborough Justice Campaign website. The other five videos are blank. The BBC also destroyed their footage of the events. And Stuart Smith watched those videos and wrote a report which made no mention of the fact that the BBC footage was blank videos.
Yeah, videos went missing left, right, and centre. I think it was this guy,
Did you want to?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I was going to ask, I actually missed the very start, probably when there was an introduction, I don't know if it was covered, but I appreciate your group as sort of voluntary as well, but I mean, how much are you able to get out and do things like this? Because I think there's tremendous support, you know, for what you're talking about amongst football supporters and people in general, more than a lot of other kind of things, you know, that football provides people quite a lot, but there seems to be a lot of togetherness with this subject. And I just feel like the benefit of actually going out and meeting groups of people, you know, possibly people affiliated to particular football clubs, to make people realise, you know, that it is about them as well, that this is a common show. It's about more than one club. And there's a danger, isn't there, that it becomes the sympathy. This is, it's a tragedy, let's mourn, and then move away, because it's just about liberty. It's not, you know, it is about everyone who might be put in this situation. And I mean, I'd love to think that other football clubs would be able to help get your group out to speak to them and kind of spread.
Well, I think the difficulty is, one, as you say, you know, sort of we are volunteers, so there's a time factor and an economic factor. But it ebbs and flows. There's times when like now that the interest is great, and you know, sort of the volume of emails and the over the last few months, the media attention and the interviews we've done, you know, all over Europe, not with, with people coming to us, and sometimes that European dimension, they're prepared to say far more, and we get away with saying much more, and they don't edit it in the same way as people do here. Yeah.
BBC Bristol refused to broadcast my interview with them. For this event, they said it was too controversial. I didn't say anything that I didn't say in the witness statements.
You just edited out. I mean,
too controversial.
Yeah, they said they wouldn't broadcast it.
It's so frustrating. You say something, you give an interview, and you go yes, yes, and then you see it or you hear it, and the most banal thing you've said, they'll keep that bit in, and it's so frustrating. I did a little bit on Channel 4 last night on Channel 4 News, just from home, and. He said, OK, that's enough. I said, OK, as long as you get in, that what I really want, and it was about this, you know, sort of evidence being released, whatever, and I said about the police, whatever, and they just said this thing I said about the families having a bad time or something, you know, something, a little platitude at the beginning as a preamble, and they kept that bit in. Moral of this is don't say them little things, but it is, we would, you know, if we're invited anywhere, we will always come along if we can. And the thing is, other clubs doing. So with that football clubs, in particular, so much of our support, I brought a little postcard because it's a postcard of a banner that's made, and it's the Celtic supporters, and you know, that might surprise you, but that's a postcard of a banner they had made for us, and it's absolutely, it's enormous, it was outside on a car park last week before it was taken in and put on the pitch for the anniversary, and it's such, and you see, if you watch the games, you'll see it, they had us at their game on Saturday, and the support they show us and the solidarity, it is just amazing. A couple come down and regularly volunteer and help in the shop. Loads of stuff they do, and so and other clubs as well, but in particular that I'd single them out as being kind of consistent. Yeah,
there's two things. One, I just wanted to talk about my experience of Hillsborough, but also to talk about the general kind of thing about the police and the way they treat us and the way you talked about police control. My experience of Hillsborough was my son was a Liverpool supporter, was at Liverpool University and always went to the matches. And that day I didn't know where he was, and so I identified with what you're saying about, you know, waiting for the phone call, and he wasn't there that day. And we went and laid flowers at the football ground and that afterwards. And it was, to me, it was a really moving experience of how the people of Liverpool got together, like you say, all across the divides that are in that city, you know, that they all sort of pulled together. But for me, sort of over those 20 years, and I've thought about the police's attitude, the way the police behaved that day, the cover-ups and all of that, and to me, nothing has changed. Nothing changed from before that, nothing has changed since. You know, I was at Lewisham, and the way that the police treated us against when we were doing anti-fascist demonstrations. I was at Grumwicks, the way the workers who were out on picket lines. And then to bring it more up to date, I was at the G20, like David talked about, on the 1st of April, and the way the police treated us was, like you said, about like animals, you know, and they kept us penned in for hours, and I had my kids with us, and I asked to leave, and they wouldn't let us leave. Yeah. Luckily, we got out about 4 o'clock before the violence started, but, you know, and the way they talked to us, we were scum. We were absolute scum. So it didn't matter why you were there. It didn't matter whether you wanted to make a peaceful protest against the finance sector and the bankers and all of that. You were all treated, just as in those days you were treated as football hooligans. Here you were treated as, you know, violent demonstrators who were about to bring the city down and that. And I think just from what Dave said, it is about, you know, sort of getting trade union support, getting community support and getting that message out. And what I've realised is talking to people about what happened on the G20, and I think that the fact that all those videos are flying about, running the Guardian, it's made people talk about the police. You know, they're actually having 3 inquiries.
And you can hear the comments, can't you, the way they're speaking to people.
Yeah, and it's all out there on Facebook, and it's on the internet. And this is kind of, you know, this is the 20th anniversary of Hillsborough, and all of a sudden it's all back in the news again, and I think it's up to all of us just to make sure that we keep up that pressure, and we affiliate to your organisation and we keep up the pressure to make the truth come out. I agree with you, I don't think it ever will. I think the cover-ups will continue, but it's up to all of
You've
us
got
to just
trying.
Keep up that pressure.
Just one other point for is just as well, that, you know, that they just rub salt into the wounds. One of the officers who was a South Yorkshire police officer who had been involved in after Hillsborough was made Chief Constable of Merseyside, Norman Betterson, and we campaigned, and I think over the course of a weekend, I think we got 25,000 signatures just in the city centre over 2 days, and then we protested at the police authority, and then we sat in at the police authority at the meeting that was, you know, to appoint him. And I mean, they were very nice. They made us tea and sandwiches, sent out the sandwiches and everything. You know, you didn't want them to be nice to you. It was worse when they're nice, isn't it? You know? But and it didn't stop him being appointed. But nevertheless, what it did again was keep in the media attention. This is what they do to people. And you know, you have to look at Merseyside Police Authority for doing that as well, which I think highlights the point that, you know, you're not picking off a particular force, although in the case of some like West Midlands, you can justifiably do that. This is the police as an organisation, and, you know, just substitute one for the other. So it's good.
Firstly, can I just say thank you so much for obviously sharing your views and everything. I don't think you've got a clap option. I think what it's done personally is all that I think I've read Phil Spratton's book on Hillsborough, and, you know, watched it last Wednesday when it was on the History Channel, and watched Hillsborough. I think when it was on in 97, it was on first. I remember watching it again recently on the Wednesday. And it's really just contextualised, obviously, how, you know, when you're speaking there, certainly some of the sort of the political issues that, you know, just by reading the book, didn't seem that, you know, sort of obvious. For my thing, first of all, I think, obviously, I think I was seven when Hillsborough happened. I wasn't really, to be honest, I'm completely unaware of anything of the day, but like my dad said, I mean, we've had opportunities to go to Liverpool sort of two or three times a, you know, season, but actually I tend to go to Bristol City a lot. And personally for me, the most important point of all of this is actually had that been a semi-final of Bristol City, and, you know, it was sort of 10 years ago. Had it been sort of 10 years ago or whenever, you know, I would have been there with my friends.
Yeah.
And actually for a situation like that, to someone to say, you know, this awful incident's happened, and yet, you know, you've tried your best to, you know, do something about it, and actually you've killed your friends, and something like that really sort of brings it home, and it's that level of sort of, you know, just awfulness, you know, because I would have been there if it had been a semi-final, and realistically as it may be, but, you know, I would have been there, and that could quite simply, you know, have been me. And I think really that's where you know, from my side, I can really feel, you know, the pain, because it's, you know, that will never go away. You know, the day after, on a Tuesday or whatever it was, on Monday, you know, that sort of pain will never really, I can't imagine it would ever be diminished. I don't know. I can't imagine what it must feel like. So from that side, personally, I can see that, you know, that's why you can never really stop campaigning because of that, you know, and whatever, you know, the truth may come out after anything like that, there's still that simple concept of actually, you know, in the worst possible time for anything to have happened, you know, you had those sort of lies being spread, you know, about you. The second thing is, if you don't mind me sort of asking, obviously you sharing, what do you feel personally and on behalf of the families is the main part, if anything, that could come out, you know, would you want to come out from, or is that a hard question? I don't know.
Well, I think what I would want to come out won't come out, which is that, you know, sort of the selective nature of the evidence. But I think what some people are saying in Liverpool is that they want the meeting between Margaret Thatcher and the police to come out. Which, see, Thatcher was up there right away. Thatcher and Colin Moynihan. Mm. Well, and I can remember survivors who were in hospital. I remember, God love me, he's dead now, the guy, but telling her where to go. You know, so don't come near my bed. It's bad enough being injured without you turning up. You know, how sensitive, you're stuck there. Yeah, you know, you're stuck in hospital. You've just got away with your life, and Margaret Thatcher comes in. So, you know, sort of basically in the hope that that would, what people are saying is that would show the level of, you know, sort of the beginnings of the cover-up. But what I would really like just brought out in some public forum, apart from what we've brought out, what I would want, if you're asking me, I think the most you'd get at some point is a ruling that there was an injustice, that would not be the wording, but that it was unfair what happened, it was wrong what happened, there was an inadequacy in terms of the inquiry, and the whole inquiry was flawed. And I was sort of hoping that that might come through Europe. I've never held, you know, Europe out there as, you know, some panacea of all ills. But nevertheless, some of the stuff I gave to the barrister acting for Anne Williams was around a precedent with three Irish guys and an inquest case, which the case had gone to Europe, and the argument was they had not received a fair hearing and an adequacy of procedure, and that was incorporated into what Anne submitted, and I was hoping that they might just get onto that because that was a precedent. But anyway, it wasn't that they didn't get onto it, they just said the thing was out of time, you know. But I do think what the first point you made around living with that is, and going back to what you know you experienced at West Ham, that total lack of control over your movements, when you know, and then to subsequently survive. So the reality is you're standing on people. There's a horrible reality in some cases, and then some of the stories I know where people, you know, sort of they knew there was someone underneath them, but if they moved to try and help them, they go under, and who of us knows what we would do unless we've been in that situation. So in that respect, I always argue that survivors are the forgotten victims of Hillsborough. Because the torment they live with.
Yeah. I'd like to see three things come out of an investigation. The first is the acknowledgement that not only did the police cause the deaths of these people, but they acted to prevent the rescue of these people. The second thing is that even while people were dying on the pitch, the police had already started to pervert the course of justice. That they immediately lied to the press and said the fans broke down the gates, that they destroyed the video evidence, that they lied about the fans being drunk and fighting, and that this was occurring when they should have been rescuing the fans. And the third thing I'd like to come out is a recognition of the bravery of the fans who confronted the police, who fought the police back time and time again across that pitch to carry out rescue attempts, as futile as they may have been, without medical treatment and medical equipment and trained medical personnel. But this continued for a good 45-50 minutes. I mean, I left after 45 minutes, so I can't say what happened beyond that time. But just constantly across the pitch, young people were confronting large numbers of policemen and forcing them back, not through fighting, but just by shouting and arguing and sheer force, of verbal force. And that went on across the pitch. I'd like to see that as the thing recognised.
Just quickly, there's you mentioned about police, you know, on horseback, and you said as well, the first response to the emerging disaster was not to send for ambulances; it was to send for dog handlers. They sent for police with dogs, and the other thing is that, I mean, just in terms of, you know, so there was a guy lived rough in Liverpool, and he wasn't that old, and I remember him, he was aggressive, and I used to avoid him because one night he'd actually grabbed me by, he asked me for money, I said no, he grabbed me by sort of round my neck, and I found him really intimidating, and anyway, so I was kind of get off me, whatever, and then there was always something familiar about him just in all that, and I was looking over old video footage, and I saw this young fresh-faced kid with a mass of curly hair, and the next time I saw this lad on the street, I said, excuse me, were you at Hillsborough? And he went to me, yeah, why? I said, did you speak to a camera? Do you remember speaking to a camera? And he went, yeah, girl, I was showing them my old ticket because no one had asked me to, you know, no one had taken me ticket off me, and he said, yeah, me, and he named his mates, one of whom was Dave Church's son, and he named, he said, yeah, so my mates died, so-and-so, 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 and he was a drug addict on the streets, and he said, didn't used to be like this girl, you know, and his whole thing, and that to me just really, really, you know, sort of the knock-on effect. I mean, okay, if it happened to anyone, it might have happened to him anyway, but I think he might have been helped along the way. It was just so sad, from this fresh-faced kid I saw on camera to this guy on the streets, aggressive, and someone you avoided. It's terrible, but it's true. And I just think it's really important that, you know, sort of those things are acknowledged.
Last week there was a film on ITV3, Hillsborough.
The Jimmy McGovern documentary, drama.
Was that how it was?
Well,
because you had Ricky Tomlinson as well.
Yeah.
And I know what Ricky thinks of Maggie Thatcher at the time, because he went through the miners.
I personally, I mean, I'm always going to be more critical because of my own involvement.
Sure,
and I have personal reasons for not being too happy with Jimmy McGovern on that first. But anyway, leaving that aside, I think it generally did open things up because it brought it. It had mass viewing, and it really did raise. It did raise the issue.
Yes.
What I didn't like, he sensationalised the inquest bit in ways that I didn't like. But that's, you know, it's licensed, isn't it? And, you know, that's what people do in a drama. But what it did was get a lot of the facts out. He actually used my inquest, the stuff I'd written around the inquest, a draft copy of that for the proposal, the initial proposal to get through to Granada. And I was kind of... I just think it did do a job. You couldn't deny it did a job. He was selective a bit with the families he used as well, but that was how he got it through all the various whatever. You know, I'm never going to be totally happy because they're never going to say, because what I want to play is never going to get on the telly, full stop, you know.
Well, my friend was, girlfriend was watching it, you know, down Southway, and, you know, over the years become a Liverpool supporter and watches all the games and this, that and the other. But when that was on, the Hillsborough thing, and... From when it was televised on Sky, it was on Sky at lunchtime, the service.
Yeah, yeah.
She sat all the way through the service, they hardly ever moved, and she watched the film. And the film on the night time, she lit two candles and put them there for the fans who died. And she broke down crying. Mm-hmm. And that's how much it got home to her. Yeah. Do you understand?
Yeah, I think
it's gone. That's gone through a lot of people.
Yeah, and but what my problem is a little bit just with the 20 years thing is that the length of time is important because and more people are now prepared to put things on the television, whatever, I don't mean that drama, but other things, and there was high profile over 20 years because it's seen as consigned to history, and more people are prepared to say sorry now because there'll be no legal consequences because they're saying sorry for whatever. And I just think what sums Hillsborough up for me, and it was actually a Catholic priest who told me this from Rotherham, who I interviewed in the very early days after Hillsborough, and he had been there and he was in the gymnasium, which was the temporary mortuary, and he said he was going round, you know, seeing the dead and whatever. And he said at 5 o'clock in the gymnasium at the Hillsborough ground, there was row after row of dead body, and all around the gymnasium walls were police officers eating Kentucky Fried Chicken. And the person I worked with on the radical professor wouldn't let me write that just plainly in the first report. He went, well, they must have been hungry. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I think my appetite might have gone.
Yeah,
so can just, because that man there and that woman
sure,
there.
Yeah, be, yeah, yeah the that's well.
Just a couple of things I want to do about the political background to it, because I lived in Liverpool in the 60s and 70s, and you have to explain that the actual hatred, particularly by the Sun, of Liverpool as a town, because the class resistance, the London class struggle in Liverpool, was utterly different from anywhere else in the country. I remember the Liverpool Trades Council was almost like a Soviet. Massive rent strike, massive, you name it, the resistance was in Liverpool. And they developed, amongst certainly the both Labour and the Tories, and the Tory press, this hatred of all things Liverpoolian, and determination to smash the city, which they did in the end. They destroyed it, its industrial base, everything away. But the other thing I want to mention is the consequences of Hillsborough. Oh, sorry, just another thing beforehand. The irony of it is that, in actual fact, Liverpool supporters didn't have a reputation for hooliganism. There was the Heysel Stadium thing, but generally, in terms of trouble at football matches, you wouldn't get them. Because I remember, you know, going to see Liverpool a lot, you wouldn't get trouble with Liverpool supporters. They weren't the great hooligan team. West Ham were, but Liverpool. But it's the consequences for football, because as part of game, I think it's a class issue. Football's been taken away from the working class. Yeah. All-seater stadiums, pricing people out of being able to watch football. Yeah. Yeah. They've used it as an excuse, not because they're interested in crowd, in safety and all the rest of it, but it's, if you like, the bourgeoisification of football. You see, they're taking over of it by business,
corporate,
you know, charging 20, God knows how much. I mean, it's impossible for the average Liverpoolian now probably to go and see Liverpool because it's difficult to get a ticket and because of the price of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember being on the Cop, you know, 24,000 people on the Cop, never mind in the rest of the, of the stadium. Yeah. And that's one of the other tragedies of Hillsborough. Not just the personal tragedies of the families, but what how they've used it as an excuse to destroy a working class activity. Yes. Where masses of working people get together to enjoy themselves in a crowd collectively.
Yeah, very sound points made there. I totally agree with that. But just say, if Liverpool had, Liverpool Sports has a reputation for anything, it was for stealing.
Yeah.
And just with a more topical point on that, after the Chelsea game last week, and coupling that with the hatred of the sun, there's a picture on, I forget where I saw it on something, but they were on one of the service stations on the way back where the next day's sun was out, so they just robbed them all and there was a ceremonial burning. And it's great to what you see, you know, direct action, you can't beat it, can you?
So I mean, we parked our car at one of the matches not far from the ground, do you understand?
Can we, sorry, there's a few other people who are ahead of you.
You know, I was 11 when Hillsborough happened, and I would say anyone who knew me in the late 80s would say, they would look at me and say nothing meant more to me than Liverpool Football Club. It was everything when I was that age, and they were everything. And I remember me and my dad talking about whether or not we were going to go, and then I can't remember why we didn't go, but we didn't go. And I really feel that it affected me profoundly. I made a scrapbook, age 11, like all these press cuttings. And I think the one thing that's come out, I've read a lot, and a lot of what you've spoken about, I knew, I've learned new things tonight. But the main feeling I get is just a sense of powerlessness. Because I talk to people about Hillsborough, you know, if I get pissed in the pub, I go on a big lecture about the, you know, inadequacies of the police on that day. And people still go, oh, was that the one where, like, all the fans got drunk and arrived late and pushed? Like, even now, it's mud sticks from the sun.
That's
people
right.
will always believe what they read. What can the average person like me, who feels strongly about it, what can the average person do?
I think what you can do is, and, you know, I direct people to our website, because what I tried to do in writing the history of Hillsborough on that was to just say it was the truth that, you know, and it's a bit warts and all, really, but it does. And I really wanted to update it for the anniversary, but just the sheer pressure of everything else, I haven't. It's just got. But basically, the history of Hillsborough, what happened from day one, is on there. So I just think, you know, you direct them to there, and basically just, you know, try to put paid to the lies that way, basically through saying, well, that wasn't the case. Because I don't know what else you can do, especially if people have, you know, sort of a blind spot around, you know. They want to believe something, you know. And you can imagine, you know, the hate every time things are churned out again. You know, imagine, you know, how families feel and how survivors feel, you know. It's just, it's horrible, it really is. And it's very frustrating because, you know, you just, all the time. But as well, the other thing is just that I brought some down and left them. Some of them you might have picked them up. Some people, and I don't really know them, they're just off some of the football forums, or what they've done is, through stuff that I've done and other people have done, they put together just a sheet which could be downloaded off the internet, and then someone gave them a bit of money before the anniversary, and they put it together, and it's just context and consequences, and there's a timeline in the back, and it refers you to other reading around it, and it's basically, you know, sort of how it was perceived. Just, it's very brief, this, and I left them the free. What I will do is, because I didn't bring that many, what I'll do is, I don't know if you won't want to take a copy of them, if you haven't seen it. What I'll do is, I'll get some sent down here as well. Just give them out, you know, I mean, they are, we've given that many of them out. But I'll get more and I'll send them if you want. Yes, it's just little things like that, I think. It is, you know, just education. That's quite heartening, you know, when that happens, when you can link up like that with other groups, other clubs, and especially when there's that distance, you know, and people still show that they care.
Gentleman there, then gentleman there.
I was just going to say, actually, that it's reiterating David's point of the fans here that were saying about perhaps the police haven't changed and they're, you know, still the same. And there's two instances that I can think of recently. When we beat Birmingham City 7-0, we were kept outside the ground for 30 minutes. We missed three goals, and the police were mocking us. every time a goal was scored, they were saying, that is the goal you'd missed. And I just was totally amazed, thinking, well, where's my major at Hillsborough? And it was my 21st, and we said to get a second ticket, and that's why I didn't go. And I just was totally amazed that for an FA Cup quarter final, that they actually did that. I totally forgot, because I actually thought, it kind of kicked off. We're hearing it, because obviously the technology's changed, people getting it through mobile phones and stuff, and getting the goals coming through. And I was amazed that that game still kicked off.
Yeah.
When for half an hour, we were still outside. But also, more recently, the following year, we went to Athens, and we were tear gassed with tickets, and there were literally 5-year-old girl by us, an 8-year-old lad by us, and we were tear gassed. I've never been tear gassed before, and hopefully never again in my life. And it causes real anger. You can see people in amongst a whole crowd of people get hit by it. It just causes you really wanting to, you almost want to kill someone. You don't know what.
By all accounts, Athens was very badly organised. I mean, generally,
it was a massive push. And the only thing that we were thinking of for the first half, where we were behind the goal, was thinking, well, so remember Hillsborough, and everyone was saying that, and we were just so placid for that first half, purely because the fact we were...
I know quite a few people who had tickets who never got in at all. They'd gone all the way to Athens and didn't get in at all. And the other thing, where you're saying you were kept outside at that game, this policy of keeping people inside, which always used to happen, that containment of, you know, not... I mean, it just raised... You're there and you're not allowed out. I mean, again, I use the analogy, you know, if it happened somewhere else in another arena, you know, at a theatre, or, you know, someone used the analogy the other day, horse racing, Ascot, you know.
On a lighter note, though, just to finish up what was the last question, though, because of obviously Everton beat Scotland yesterday, is there a sort of positive rapport in Liverpool that perhaps Everton will actually bring back the cup on the 20th anniversary?
Well, the thing was, yesterday at the ground, at the Everton game, there were several banners calling for justice for the 96. And, you know, I mean, that rivalry between... I have to say, I come from a family of Evertonians. I have a cousin who's a former captain of Everton, and I've always been a Liverpudler. I was the only one with foresight and intellect, you know. and, you know, sort of... Everton were a better team at the time when I supported them as a child. But, so the point is, I know that rivalry, but this transcends the thing. And I think that, you know, sort of most people I know wanted Everton to win yesterday. There'll be no love lost when they win it. I mean, it'll, you know, just the usual stuff. But, you know, what a choice. Yeah, them
the 89 final after Hillsborough was between Liverpool and Everton. My greatest memory of that match is 80,000 people. Everton and Liverpool fans combined drowning out the national anthem by singing Merseyside. Yeah. Reminded me when Andy Burnham was drowned out the other day. Yeah, very similar thing, just spontaneous, not planned, but very powerful.
Shall we just take the question from this gentleman? We've been waiting a long time.
I was wondering if this campaign received what sort of support it received, if any, from the players at the time.
The Justice campaign wasn't in existence at the time, but at the time of the disaster, immediately after, the football player, the players were very good in attending funerals and the club in sending the players, etc. And some, you know, went to more funerals than others did, and there was that support. But over time, and it shames me to say it, that when it gets what they deem to be political, the pull back, the players, they're told to have nothing to do. And I have to say, you know, we're neighbours, our campaign is neighbours, we're right opposite the ground, you know, right opposite the cop. And we have footballs from everywhere, you know, signed footballs. And the only one we don't have is a Liverpool one. Liverpool never said, they don't acknowledge us, they just acknowledge the family support group. Even though every home game, the ground is just full of Liverpool supporters with our badges, our banners they've made supporting us. It's a bizarre situation. But the whole thing is, it's deemed to be political. But I have to say, in terms of the support we get, there is one person who does give us support more than anyone else, and it's Jamie Carragher. The support we have, we can send anything to Jamie to be signed, to auction, whatever, and it's back the next day. He just is basically, you know, sort of, he never really wants to be up the, you know, sort of on the platform. He just wants to be amongst his mates, and he really is a good supporter of our group.
Was it was it kind of was it on the way that the thing of the crushing against the wire fences? I mean, how long were wire fences in place, and were there examples of very near incidents leading up to Hillsborough?
That's probably a
question. Yeah.
First wire fences were put up by our old friend Mr. Ken Bates in about 19. I think he went through about 85, 86. So you've got, by the end of the 80s, you've got a lot of football stadiums with the big wires up to separate the crowd from the pitch. So you've got about 5 or 6 years of that. I mean, interestingly, in comparison to Greece, they do the same thing in Greece to this day, but it's very thin netting, mainly to stop kind of missiles. Greek crowds do have a tendency to throw missiles on the pitch. But this was actually, you know, if you actually look at the wire, you know, this is serious fencing. This is like Guantanamo Bay job. I mean, and Ken Bates actually, I think, originally wanted to have it electrified fences was the original plan.
And he totally forgot about that, didn't he? Do you remember?
Yes, well, amongst many things that Mr. Bates has managed to forget over the years.
Like were there near crushing people?
Well, I mean, you know, there have been enormous numbers of...
2 years before at Hillsborough, there was a crush. Yeah. And a whole load of fans had to climb over the top onto the pitch.
1946. I mean, the thing is that this has been going on for 100 years. 1946, Bolton, 43 people dead, completely eradicated from most conventional history. It's totally forgotten. I mean, it's, you know...
Ibrox.
Ibrox 1971, massive crush on the stairs, over 30 people killed. 1902, Ibrox, collapse of a wooden stand, over 100 killed.
Bradford Fire,
85. So in the UK, you've had a number of incidents.
And there'd been government reports. I mean, Popplewell reported on the state of, you know, football grounds after Bradford, and yet nothing's implemented. There's no changes implemented. It was only after Hillsborough and Taylor.
Well, you have changes, but it's all about policing. It's all about treating football fans and football crowds, you know, as the enemy. I mean, you know, lessons were learned and implemented, but they were all learned from policing the miners' strike and equivalent industrial disputes of the early 1980s. So you did have wires beforehand. You did have changes in policing, and all pretty much uniformly negative. Prior to Hillsborough. Roger.
Yeah, well, I just want to come on to one thing. I've heard a bit about, just quickly on the one of the phones I heard this week, one of the Tottenham fan phoned in and said, and he did not know about the tunnel business. Right? He talked about being at a game, I can't remember, we're still trying to track down which game it was, I think it was against Wolves or something.
Yes, Wolves, yeah.
Yeah, that's 80. Right, and he said that the same thing had happened. Yeah. Right? He said there's a horrible tunnel we went about, because most people don't know about the tunnel, I don't even know about the tunnel of Dan. But most people don't know about this tunnel, and he said, I was pushing this tunnel by police on horseback, we were crushed, and we told them, he said, and we all popped out the other end, like that. And he said, and it was absolutely frightening. He said, there were loads of complaints on the day, nothing was done, it was all ignored. So clearly it was a, you know, not only were the policing and the design of the ground was a joke, that tunnel was a nightmare, the whole thing was designed. The other thing I got pissed off about this week was the BBC's continual go on about terracing. It became the whole debate, as far as I could tell, the BBC became about terracing by the end of the week. And there was one, the only decent bit, well, people were arguing about it, but one person came in and said, who was a stadium designer, I don't know if you heard him on Radio 5, and he came and said, well, yeah, but what's the problem? He's got terracing in Germany is designed properly, and it's, you know, things are done right. It's actually less dangerous to have terracing than it is to have seats where everyone stands up. You know, he's got this whole argument got diverted about Hillsborough.
We get asked about that an awful lot, and even within our group, there's differences of opinion. My own argument is standing never killed anyone. It's the surrounding circumstances, situation around pens and stuff. And yet, other people will disagree with me on that. And that was why I was a little bit annoyed with the service on Wednesday. Was that got hijacked a bit, and then a lot of survivors weren't too happy that it become a little bit of a lecture against standing at football grounds.
I mean, to add to that, I mean, internationally, if you take the evidence, I mean, no disaster is caused merely by the existence of terracing, even inadequate terracing. I mean, in any almost every case I can think of. You know, there are other factors. I mean, the worst football disaster on record is Peru, 1964. 463 people die in a crush. And why did it happen? Because they fired tear gas into the crowd. You know, it's not about terracing or, you know. Similarly, you know, what at you know, the Luzhniki in the Soviet Union, 1981, 210 people die, you know, on a terrace. But then why are you allowing a massive crowd to go onto a terrace that's got kind of 5 or 6 inches of ice and has turned basically, you know, into a kind of ski slope, you know? So, and if you want cover-ups, I mean, that's the cover-up of all time. I mean, you know, the Soviet authorities, you know, saying 2-3 people dead basically the next day, still haven't fully admitted it. So I do think the standing thing is a complete red herring. And my experience of standing in on giant terraces with you know, quite wild crowds is actually there is an incredible degree of self-regulation amongst most crowds, particularly where you have long-established traditions of people standing in those stadiums operating as a crowd. And it's actually almost invariably external interventions of one kind or another that generate chaos in those crowds. Once you start panicking people, or similarly in Ghana, 2001 in Accra, 250 people die at the big Ghana derby. And again, tear gas. People, you start firing tear gas, people panic, and you've got locked gates. I mean, in those cases, you know, they're actually locking the gates, you know, that people have come into. When people try and get out to get away from the tear gas, they end up in corridors and everybody piles behind them. The same thing happened at River Plate in Argentina in 1968. The Olympiacos deaths. Which I think was 1981. Same thing. Tear gas. I mean, what is anybody doing anywhere under any circumstances firing tear gas into a football crowd? I don't care what level of disorder is going on. What are you doing firing tear gas? I mean, you know, it is absolutely beyond the pale of any kind of reason to be doing that. So I do think, you know, the standing issue is, it's a terrible diversion from the real issues.
I think
the real
point you make about self-regulation is just brief. I went to watch Liverpool from I was 7, and I started off with my friend. They didn't live too far from the ground, and we just used to walk up, two little girls going, you know, you can't imagine it now, kind of 2 7-year-olds. And we used to go in what was known as the boys' pen, and a friend of mine, is, you know, he writes poetry and stuff, and he wrote this thing, and it's all, and I used to say girls used to go in there as well, because, you know, there was never any mention of that. But by the time we were 11, we'd progressed to the cop, and the size, someone there was saying, you know, the number of people on the cop, and I can remember, you know, the sway forward when there's a goal in it and you come back, and I lost my shoe, and I was quite shy and I wouldn't ask anyone or anything, and so I was like, oh, I'll just have to go home and my mum will be, you know, batter me basically because I'm going home with one shoe on. And someone at the front shouted, there's a shoe, and I just took this man next to me and said, you know what, that's mine. And they went, oh, and they just passed my shoe back up. And what people used to do, going, hey, there's two little girls here, and they'd sort of form this little thing around. You were always safe, you know. It wasn't that my mother didn't care about you. You were quite safe.
Football grounds anywhere else. Yeah. City Coventry match, I felt completely safe with sort of like 20,000 people there.
Yeah, it's those other circumstances, if you just said. Yeah.
I've left him on the cup when I've gone to the toilet, and he's somebody's looking after him. You know, which he is.
Yeah. Gentleman at the back.
I've seen on your website about the resistance you've had from the original supporters,
blocking your website
or just such that.
Yeah.
Discuss questions. Other things that they've done, and why did they do that?
It's really so sad, you know, but basically, yes, I mean, when I said before about being in court and getting threatened with imprisonment, the really sad thing was you had this awful situation of two bereaved fathers and survivor there being threatened with imprisonment by other bereaved families, and you go, what's happened here, when, you know, and different agendas and different influences around people advising them, and I never want to go down that road of kind of being overtly critical, but I do think the truth, and, you know, again, I think when we were going up to Leeds just to be there when those private prosecutions were going on, and again, this is on the website, I was travelling up with families who were in the family support group, and they were just travelling back and forth every day from Leeds, because they couldn't afford to stay. And basically, the committee was staying in the Hilton Hotel. And when they had stayed over, because there was the jury was out and wherever, they were given a few pounds to find a B&B. And we actually gave them money from our group. We didn't have much money in the group. And basically, we never had any money. But basically, those sorts of differences just really became very deeply entrenched, where if you were going to London, if they were going down to London, they'd go down first class and the other families would be on coaches. And it's class. It's class. Bottom line, it's class. And I've seen it. It's horrible, you know. And I used to see it physically happen at meetings with the solicitors and the barristers and the steering committee of solicitors. I saw it in Manchester Town Hall. And I was sitting down there with all the families. And the chair of the steering committee of solicitors said to the chair of the family support group, "Oh, don't speak from down there. Come up here." And the symbolism was great. Come up amongst us. You're one of us. And it sounds over. And, you know, there's another arena for analysing all that. But it's, you know, because I can put sort of my objective head on and I can analyse it all. It's very sad. And counterproductive.